got the microphone working there. So first, let me just in passing mention this little article that has been handed out tonight. It's entitled, What Makes 7 a Perfect Number? God Used It Repeatedly, But Why? This is just something that I pulled off the internet, which I hope you'll read through, especially the really large paragraph down there. And where I see now, I guess I got a comma out of place. Should be after September instead of down by itself on the third line there. But interesting information that I think will help us again later in the book. So it's not going to come up tonight about calendars here, but I printed this out for both reasons. I wanted you to see that. And then I'll just read the last part of this, the last paragraph for the sake of the recording. So the gist of all the above is that there's less there than meets the eye. There's little point in trying to read mystical significance into the curious combinations of numbers or number systems. There is no scriptural information that attaches particular esoteric significance to any one number or number system over any other. I did some research on this myself this week. It's been very interesting to me for some time. And I noticed something this week that I hadn't seen before. I've got quite a few commentaries, maybe that many, you know, on a shelf at home, that deal with this mystical number 666, which we'll be dealing with here tonight, and the various approaches that people have trying to calculate the number. What does that mean? And most of these will key off the number 7, which, by the way, appears in your Old and New Testaments together some 550 times, something like that. It's just huge, well over 500 times. Now, the bulk of these, of course, are to be understood very literally. There's 7 days in a week, and on the seventh day you do this. You know, well, you're just counting, and it's not representative of anything. It's just that's what happened. It's very physical, very literal. But it's been suggested that the number 7 somehow is intended by God to represent either, and then it'll depend on who you're talking to, fullness or completion or perfection or divinity. They'll use a number of different terms, and it's been interesting to me through the years. Frequently, they'll say essentially exactly the same thing about the number 10. You'll see various attempts to try to say that in Scripture, 10 should be always viewed as representing, again, completion, totality, you know, perfection or something like that. And all the years that I've been a Christian and studying this out, I've never been convinced that that was so. No matter how I was teaching the book of Revelation or looking at these numbers, I think that last paragraph on that page said it the best, that I could find no scriptural reason to reach those conclusions. So to say that 6 is less than 7 and therefore we should interpret it, you know, in a certain manner cannot be found in Scripture. So I'll leave it to you. You know, you look at it. But what I hadn't noticed before is that I discovered that several of my commentaries, without giving a reference, were using so much identically the exact same sentence about how the ancient Jews used to do this that it was very apparent that the various commentators were quoting each other, but nobody was quoting a source. So I've never been able to find, you know, who those supposed rabbis are or why it is that we're supposed to think this. But the oldest commentary I could find, which isn't very old at all, was by the Baptist William Hendrickson, called More Than Conquerors, was at least the oldest one in print, certainly before Homer Haley and McGiggin, Jim McGiggin, and some of these others. And so I just wanted you to see that, and that's really all I wanted to say about it tonight. You'll have to work with that yourself, but I'm suggesting that numbers like words, and I think the hermeneutic principle is it hermeneutical? Adverbial phrase, I guess. Anyway, the idea is that you will take a thing in its most basic, common, literal, concrete understanding first and stay there unless you've got something in the context that would indicate other. And I'm willing to accept in the context, not just the surrounding words or a paragraph or two, and not even just the New Testament, but also the Old Testament. So we're going to be dealing a lot with numbers, especially starting tonight, but it's going to be coming out quite a bit later too. And we'll see, you know, what we're going to do with them, but some numbers, I think, can be understood in a sort of a, you know, symbolic manner. I'm not questioning that they couldn't be. I'm just suggesting, I think the great majority of the time, both with numbers that are referencing some count, as well as numbers that have to do with time, that in your Bible, those numbers should at least first, you know, be understood in that manner, and then only later, if the context gives us a reason, should we look for anything else or expect anything else. So I'll leave all that to you tonight. Let's get started. Tonight, we're going to be looking into Revelation chapters 13 and 17. It is my way, as you've learned, to want to read the whole context, at least of the chapter that we'll be studying tonight. So I'm going to read uninterrupted all of chapter 13. But in like manner to last week, I'm also going to read tonight chapter 17. So we're not going to study 17. We'll come back and do it verse by verse in a few weeks. But chapter 13 and chapter 17 really go together, as you'll see from the reading. And as a matter of fact, chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20 are talking about this beast, this sea beast that's going to rise up in chapter 13. So this beast is really going to dominate the rest of the book. Whatever this is, this sea beast, very, very prominent. If I'm not mistaken, there's only two chapters. There'll be two chapters from 13 to 20 that don't reference this beast somewhere, somehow. So it's going to behoove us, of course, to figure out what this is, because it's just immensely prominent now in the second half of the book of Revelation. So first, let's get the reading under our belts, and then we'll try to pick it apart verse by verse. Chapter 13, I think the he refers to that dragon that we saw last week, which was identified as Satan, the devil. He stood on the sand of the seashore. And I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear. And his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon, because he gave his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who is able to wage war with him?" There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. He opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, those who dwell in heaven. And it was given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. Let me stop the reading for just a moment. Please note, when we get into chapter 17, that in like manner, there is, and I'm going to use the term very hesitantly because I don't mean to demean the individual, but there's a sidekick. There's this beast, this sea beast, that's the big deal. But then there's this other something that bears a relationship that is subservient somehow, but that is lending his powers, considerable as they are, to that beast. So, from chapter 12, with the introduction of Satan himself, we now come to a beast that is most prominent throughout essentially the rest of the book. That beast is given his power by the dragon, by Satan. But there'll be a third individual that now is helping, that is pushing people to serve that beast, the sea beast. So remember that when we get over to chapter 17 as well. Verse 11, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. And he makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. And he performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down out of heaven to the earth in the presence of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which it was given him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come to life. And there was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast might even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, the small and the great, and the rich and the poor, and the freemen and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead, and he provides that no one should be able to buy or to sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. Now, before we get to chapter 17, skip down to chapter 14 and look at verse 9. Another angel, a third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and his image and receives a mark on his forehead or upon his hand, he also will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. The smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day and night, those who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. Skip down to chapter 15. Look at verses 1 and 2. I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels who had seven plagues, which are the last, because in them the wrath of God is finished. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mixed with fire, and those who had come off victorious from the beast and from his image and from the number of his name, standing on the sea of glass, holding harps of God. And they sang the song of Moses, the bondservant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, great and marvelous are your works, O Lord God the Almighty. Righteous and true are your ways, you King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy, for all the nations will come and worship before you, for your righteous acts have been revealed. Chapter 16 and verse 1. I heard a loud voice in the temple saying to the seven angels, go and pour out the seven bowls of the wrath of God into the earth. The first angel went and poured out his bowl into the earth, and it became a loathsome and malignant sore upon the men who had the mark of the beast and who worshipped his image. Down at verse 13, I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet three unclean spirits like frogs, for they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the whole world, that is, by the way, oikumene, to gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. Behold, I am coming like a thief. Skip now down to chapter 17, which we will read in its entirety. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I shall show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication. Those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her fornication. And upon her forehead a name written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered greatly. And the angel said to me, why do you wonder? I shall tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss and to go to destruction. And those who dwell on the earth will wonder, whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast, that he was and is not and will come. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits, and they are seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while. And the beast, which was and is not, is himself also an eighth, which is one of the seven, and he goes to, and there's some question here, either to destruction, which would indicate that he gets destroyed, or to destroying, which means that he's the one that does the destroying. The Greek allows either. In verse 12, the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns which you saw and the beast, these will hate the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire. For God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose and by giving their kingdom to the beast until the words of God should be fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Now that should be perfectly plain to you. Maybe it's not. But let's not forget now, skip ahead. It's chapter 18 where there is no reference. But come to chapter 19, and in verse 19, I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the horse and against his army. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet, who performed the signs in his presence by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire which burns with brimstone. And the rest were killed with the sword which comes out from the mouth of him who sat upon the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. And I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the abyss, and shut it, and sealed it over him, so that he should not deceive the nations any longer, until 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of the testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received the mark on their forehead and upon their hand, and they came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until 1,000 years were completed. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ, and will reign with him for 1,000 years. When 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand of the seashore. And they came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. And fire came down from heaven and devoured them. Now, I'll just stop there. All right. What did chapter 12 open up with? Be careful now. What did 12 open up with? It's the woman, right? What's the second figure that we see? The dragon waiting to devour the third, which is? The male child, which will rule with a rod of iron. And then the woman's given the wings of the evil eagle after we have this 42 months and 1,260 days. And so for the 1,260 days, she flees where? The wilderness, where place is prepared, seeing she is protected. Flowing directly out of that, we are introduced to the beast of chapter 13. And that beast will be lingering, if not towering over, everything that takes place right down to the end of the book now. So, what in the world is it? Okay. First, if I can direct your attention to the screen now, I'd like you to just see a number of charts, and then we'll go verse by verse. The sea beast of chapter 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, well, 16, that sea beast is the main character in chapter 13, but is also woven, as I've just read, into the warp and woof of this. Chapter 14, verse 9 he's mentioned, verse 11 he's mentioned, 15:2, 16:2, and 16:13. I'm maintaining, brethren, that it is identical with the scarlet beast of chapter 17. Okay? Now, nothing is said about scarlet in chapter 13. The scarlet only comes up one time, and it's way over there in chapter 17. But still, I'm sure they're not different beasts. So, we'll learn that 17, the beast we saw back in 13, 14, 15, and 16, was in fact scarlet. The scarlet beast, though, is the major character in chapter 17. And also, as I read, 19, 19, and 20, and then in 20, verse 4, specifically. Now, here's what the beasts have in common, which leads me to conclude that they have got to be exactly the same beast, and therefore represent exactly the same, I'm not wrong here, things, plural. I think the one beast represents things, plural. We'll see why in a bit. Number one, these beasts are both stipulated to have seven heads. They both have 10 horns. They both have these blasphemous names that are associated with them. They both have an image that is made of them, and that is worshipped. They both make war with the saints slash with Jesus, Jesus and his army. And then the earth beast in chapter 13, the second beast, not the sea beast, the earth beast, the one that comes out of the earth, not out of the sea, that beast is the false prophet, identified as such, as you saw in the reading tonight, before you get to chapter 17 and 18 or 19 and 20, where the term false prophet's used again. So, at least six different ways, and there's probably more, but at least six really major ways. The scarlet beast of 17, 18, 19, and 20 surely must be the sea beast of 13, 14, 15, and 16. They are one and the same, whatever they are. Now then, if you don't get these verse references, maybe I should put this on a tape. With the seven heads, it's chapter 13, verse 1, and chapter 17, verse 7. With the 10 horns, chapter 13, verse 1, and 17, 7 again. Blasphemous names in 13, 1, and 17, 3. The image is worshipped in 13, 15, and 19, 20. Made war with the saints, Jesus at the head of the army in 13, 7. In 19:19, and then the earth beast of 13 equals the false prophet of chapter 17. All right then. Here's one depiction. And what you're going to find, brethren, as people think about how should we imagine what John saw, how should we depict it, you know, today, of course there's just legions of attempts to do so. I do think there's value in these. I wouldn't give you, you know, these pictures, if I didn't think so, but emphasizing again that they're not remotely, you know, correct, I'm sure. I don't find anything very threatening about that, to tell the truth, but I think John did when he viewed these beasts. You know, but at least it gives you, you know, some kind of an approximation. But the color's wrong, isn't it? Because if I'm right, and I'm pretty sure this has to be the case, you know, well, what color should it be? It ought to be scarlet. See, that we don't learn until chapter 17, but people don't see the connection, so they usually paint 13 without any scarlet color. It's just yourself we're going to find that, as a matter of fact. So the sea beast, though, is something like this. Its paws are like bears, not like the leopard that it's said to look like in the body, though, you know, it has at least the mouth of a lion, which will have to do, I guess, as much with the roar as it does with the, you know, with the teeth or the face there. But at least, you know, there's one attempt to give us some kind of an idea of the monstrosity that the beast is. This one, I guess, a little bit better. Although I never saw a bear that looked anything like that, you know, when it came to paws, but, you know, he's trying. And at least, again, you know, you can see what I was maintaining last week with the dragon having 12 heads. It is a dragon. I know we think in terms of a dragon that has to have a long serpentine kind of a neck, but, you know, I'm not so sure about that. And in this case, the heads are clustered more. And we're kind of getting there, I guess, you know, on the color. But then again, it looks more like it's coming out of fire than coming out of water, doesn't it? You know, so, you know, I don't know, maybe that's, you know, missing the point there, too. Here's my personal favorite. Because while the woman of chapter 17, that great harlot Babylon, see, is not mentioned in 13, 14, 15, 16, she shows up on the beast, riding the beast, in chapter 17. We got color right finally, or at least, you know, kind of close right here. And again, helpful, I think, you know, with the horns thing. Seven heads, 10 horns. How do you do that? I don't know. Do three of the horns, the heads rather, have two horns? Does one head have four horns? Does one head have 10 horns? There aren't any horns in the head. You know, I don't know. I know there's a distribution that takes place there, you know, somehow. And then there's this harlot who is drunk with the what? the blood of the saints and the ones that testified, who are the witnesses as well. That word witness, we'll probably do a little side study on one of these days. Very critical. You remember I spent a lot of time on it when we were in the early going in the book of Acts. Tried to point out to you that that word witnesses is not used very commonly of just anybody. But it is used very specifically and uniquely throughout several chapters in the early going and later of the book of Acts as referring very significantly, personally, and exclusively to the apostles, not just to all saints. The witnesses were the apostles. Those witnesses, blood is in that cup. That's something to remember. So, there's, you know, my personal favorite. It gets a little better, I guess, on the Bears. Jerry, have you ever brought a bear down? Jerry, have you ever dropped a bear?
Have I ever what?
Dropped a bear.
Dropped a bear? I've never picked one up.
All right? That's it. I'm not going to call on you anymore. Have you ever killed a bear, Jerry?
No.
No? Okay. Rats, I was hoping for a good story. Okay. Bears are pretty impressive thing. I probably told you my story already. If I haven't, you can ask me later. But I came face to face with one only one time, and memorable experience. Okay, we'll get to Revelation 13 in a minute. I was supposed to not put that up. Let's see if I can get it back. Here we go. Okay, back to chapter 13, and here we go. Now then, brethren, I've spent a little over half of my time helping you to see the larger context. Getting all of that data into your mind. There are so many clues to what this sea beast is. So many clues. We're only going to deal with a few of them here tonight. Lot of clues. But, surprisingly maybe, the great majority of commentators pretty well all come to the same thing that I do. I'm an early gator in Revelation. I think it's talking about the fall of Jerusalem. We'll see that very prominently in chapters to come. But pretty well, everybody looks at this and they say, well, this has got to be wrong. Somehow, some way, that beast is talking about Rome. And like I say, just about any commentary you want to talk or read, you know, there it is. We pretty well come to the same conclusion. Now, individual parts of this, what a given head or horn might represent, that's another matter. And there's a wide range of disagreement on that, but at least, you know, everybody thinks in terms of, pretty much, among saints and churches of Christ, he stood on the sand of the seashore, the dragon did, a beast came up out of the sea. Remember I showed you chapter 17 and verse 15, the sea over there is identified for us as meaning Gentiles. It's coming up out of the Gentile world, having 10 horns, 7 heads, on its horns 10 diadems, on its heads blasphemous names, like a leopard, feet like a bear, mouth like the mouth of a lion, dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. Whatever it is, tremendous power of an earthly, sensual, demonic nature. That is using, you know, James, but to say that it is carnal, material, political, you know, evil, fleshly, it is a thing that comes up out of, I think, certainly, gentility in the worst possible way. Gentility is supposed to be a good thing. But if we're using it to represent Gentiles, you know, there's not anything very, very good about this. Then we have this statement in 3. One of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast and worshipped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. They worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to what with him? Wage war. So once again, what is associated with the beast is tremendous authority and power from Satan, and blasphemous names, and now in chapter 13 and down in verse 3, somehow one of the heads is slain, and then it gets healed, the thing gets worshipped, And most especially at the end of verse 4, it is terrifyingly powerful militarily. Who can wage war, you know, against that? So as we're getting one thing after another, trying to understand what the beast is, you can see how these various descriptive phrases tend to get us thinking in terms of Rome. It was militarily the best the world had ever seen for a long time past and for a long time to come. It was with tremendous authority. It was tremendously worldly. It was blasphemous. It's all these things. So I'll leave it to you then to go back and read my notes and study the material in the first block. I can't read all of Daniel 7 over again, okay, like we did last week. But look at that block. In the third line, same heads, horns, and crowns seen on the dragon, identified as Satan in Revelation 12:3. And then, much the same vision as Daniel 7. Look especially at the first seven verses in Daniel 7. And then look at verses 16, 17, and 18. Then look at 23, 24, and 25. Go back and do that again. Tonight, tomorrow, sometime this week. And in Daniel chapter 7, verse 17, compared with verse 23 in that chapter. I won't take you back. I don't have the time. You'll see it. We read it last week. There, beasts equals kings and equals kingdoms at the same time. There's the plurality of a single symbol representing two things, a kingdom and an individual king over that kingdom. Okay? And in Daniel 7:24, compared with what I didn't read last week, chapter 8, verses 20, 21, and 22, you'll find that horns equals kings and equals kingdoms. Once again, Daniel is interpreting for us symbols employed by the book of Revelation. Hebrew symbols from the Hebrew Old Testament, which would be very well recognized by the Hebrews among the saints scattered throughout Asia. There were many scattered throughout Asia, Jews everywhere in the Roman Empire. But brethren, beasts equals kings and kingdoms. Horns equals kings and kingdoms in Daniel. That should help us when we're looking over here in Revelation. Okay, then one more thing. Please note the seven heads part. Seven mountains equals seven kings in chapter 17, verses 9 through 11. So, these mountains, these horns, and these beasts represent physical kingdoms on the earth beyond all doubt in Daniel. And ought to then, when the exact same imagery is carried into the New Testament at the book of Revelation, and I'm quite certain should be understood in the same manner. We're looking at kingdoms and kings. Now, the slain head. What's the slain head? Brethren, I don't know. I'll give you this idea. I think it's a strong one. There are others that are proposed with regard to the Roman Empire. Several different approaches to this would still get you to having something to do with a particular moment in time, a given head, which is a king, which is a kingdom, you know, which is a part, though, of the Roman Empire, part of one beast. So I'm suggesting Julius Caesar. At his death, it seemed that the empire was mortally wounded. 13 years later, Augustus resurrected it. What are the kings of the Roman Empire called?
Emperor.
Well, yes. Got good on that one. But with regard to Julius, they're called Caesars. They wear his name. Now, people often argue, and we'll get into this a lot in a little while, chapter 17, but you know, people really argue hard that shouldn't be Julius because Julius should never be counted as the first emperor. And yes, it is true that there was a triumvirate and it was a republic, but he did get murdered
And he was making his play to be the number one guy. Every other emperor, starting with Augustus 14 years later, takes his name to be representative of an emperor. If you're an emperor, you're a Caesar, is what you are. Okay? So what I'm suggesting is that Julius was killed at 2 who? That's right. Because they did not like the fact that he had taken on himself the powers of an emperor. They didn't want that. They wanted the republic, so they killed him. But they got that empire anyway, didn't they? So the wound, if we think of it in those terms of the death of an empire, actually became, you know, an empire anyway. It was healed. That's one way to look at it. If you have another, you know, I'm fine with that, but you're going to be stuck pretty well, I think, with the Roman Empire, no matter how you cut the particular head. Now, let's go then down to verse 4. They worship the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. They worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him. Satan's behind the scenes, as I suggested last week. Satan is pushing everything from a spirit world. Down here on earth, there's a monster wreaking havoc that is the Roman Empire. And that Roman Empire, in verse 4, was surely worshipped. And let no one tell you differently, because in decades gone past, but still in our lifetime, you may read a lot in various older commentaries, but fairly contemporary, 20th century commentaries, that Rome was never worshipped. That is not so. Though, the archaeological evidence that has come to light since those commentaries were written is most compelling, those authors were probably not aware of it. It hadn't been discovered yet. Now it's been unquestionably proven that Rome was being worshipped as a god, as were emperors, long before the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD and throughout the Roman Empire. Emperor worship was rolling along just famously, thank you, and doing quite well, long before Domitian came along in the 90s. Older commentaries didn't know that. Newer ones recognized the historical archaeological fact. But the older ones, you know, weren't aware, apparently. Now, that beast is the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was worshipped, as was its individual king, Dea Roma. The god Rome is found in idolatrous form in several different cities now. If you go then to verse 5, mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, authority to act for how long? In days? 1260. In years? In times? Time, times, and half a time. Hark back to Daniel as well. Now let's go to verse 7, 6. He opened his mouth in blasphemies against God to blaspheme his name in his tabernacle. That is those who dwell in heaven. Now, 42 months, all those other time frames, they're exactly the same as the Roman invasion in Israel. That's a historical fact. It's a time reference, which I think even in the book of Revelation ought to be taken that way first, unless you have some biblical reason to do differently. And so we then have in verse 6, those who dwell in heaven as opposed to those who dwell on earth, a term that's frequently found in the book of Revelation. We'll take a side study in just a moment on those who dwell on the earth. It was given to him to make war with the saints. Well, there are those who dwell in heaven and overcome them. No authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. Beyond all doubt, Rome killed Jesus. But who was held accountable for that murder? The Jews by Jesus and nobody else in Matthew 23 and 24. Rome made war against Old Testament saints. That is, conquered Israel in 64 B.C. Julius sent one of his generals to do it. And you have the persecution then, not only of the saints, but who were Old Testament saints, but of New Testament saints, you know, after Christ established his kingdom, at the instigation, though, of the Jews. They're pushing Rome into it, as you read in the book of Acts against Paul. Now then, in 8, all who dwell on the earth will worship him. And they are identified as those whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. So then clearly these people are not what? They're not Christians. and or they were not faithful Jews prior to the time of Jesus, but they are not pleasing in the sight of God. Now, please do, as my notes suggest, somewhere, I forget where, and go back to chapter 6 in your notes. Come to chapter 6. Again, for the sake of time. It's really tough to do this, you know, one chapter 9, maybe I just shouldn't, but I think it's helpful if we try at least. Look on your notes in chapter 6 at something that I did not take the time to go through back in chapter 6. It is just at the halfway point underneath the block, where, or the boxed information, where you have special note regarding the expression, those who dwell on the earth. This is a really, I think, a very important principle in understanding the book of Revelation. Gase, which is Strong's 1093, is translated earth and used 68 times in the New Testament. When English speakers today say earth, we think planet. It's not what the Greeks would think. It sometimes could mean planet, but that's not the first and foremost, instant and only approach like we do today in our language. In Matthew 13:5, it apparently means dirt is what the, you know, seed's planted in. But look at the first three uses of this word in the New Testament. Matthew 2:6, 2:20 and 21, and 4:15. In those texts, it is best translated land, not earth, of Judah. Land, not earth, of Israel. Land, not earth, of Zebulun. And land, not earth, of Naphtali. This word, gase, much more frequently, brethren, is referring to a land, a geographical area that is smaller than the whole planet, that is identifiable as being distinct from other lands that are elsewhere. But this earth thing should not instantly call to mind a globe floating out in space, third from the sun. It's just a mistake for us to do that. We need to look more carefully at the concepts that are actually attached to that word. This is the word for those who dwell on the earth. They dwell on the land. What is that land? What is that? Now, you got the whole list here, and again, for those in the tape, this those who dwell on the earth expression has already been seen in chapter 3, verse 10, chapter 6, verse 10, that's that fifth seal, chapter 8, verse 13, chapter 11, verse 10, now it comes up in chapter 13, verses 8, 12, and 14, chapter 14, verse 6, chapter 17, verses 2 and 8. But Revelation 13, 8 and chapter 14, 3 define them in two ways. First, they are not saved. They are not in the Lamb's Book of Life. But in 14:6, they are also separated from unsaved Gentiles. Now, I didn't go through all this back then, but this matters, brethren. What is this expression used so often in the book of Revelation? Those that dwell on planet Earth. No! It's those who dwell on the earth that are not Gentiles and are not saved. Who dwells on the earth that are not Gentiles and not saved? Jews who rejected the Messiah. There are no Jews after the fall of Jerusalem. That's all obliterated and wiped out. It's impossible to be one today. There are no genealogical records. So, that expression, brethren, very clearly, when you get all the pieces, says unsaved Jews is what that expression means. That's what it says when you put all the identifying marks together. Now back to our chapter 13. In chapter 13 and at verse 8, all who dwell on the earth, these unsaved Jews, will worship him whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. By the way, we should do this 14:6. I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on the earth and to every nation and tribe and tongue and people. So to Jews, as opposed to Gentiles, and thanks to 13:8, the Jews, as opposed to Gentiles, that are not in the Lamb's Book of Life. Verse 9,
You got to pay attention. You have to think about these things. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. It's not lying on the surface, not straightforward, not real easy. So in 10, if anyone is destined for captivity, which is not a thing that happens up in heaven to anybody, after the end of planet Earth, as we think of it, there isn't any captivity like that. It's over. People aren't living anymore. If anyone kills with the sword, there's no more killing with the sword after the final judgment. Whatever we're talking about goes on before the final judgment. With the sword, he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and faith of the saints, all who are enduring the great tribulation Jesus had prophesied in Matthew 24 at the moment that Revelation is written. Verse 11, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, spoke as a dragon, exercised all the authority of the first beast in his presence, makes the earth and those who dwell in it worship the first beast, whose fatal wound was healed, performs great signs, even makes fire come down from heaven in the presence of men, deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which it was given him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come to life. There was given him to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast might even speak, this idol, whatever it is, and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, the small and the great, the rich, the poor, the freemen and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. He provides that no one should be able to buy or sell, except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. All right. Come on over to my notes. It'll be the fastest way to summarize in a couple of minutes. Chapter 13, verses 11 through 15. Revelation, 19:20, identifies this guy as the false prophet. This symbol refers to something that would make you think of a false prophet. Three times, and more than anything else, in Matthew 24, Jesus talks about false prophets. All these things will take place in this generation, he said. But three times before that, he's dealing with false prophets, which were rampant throughout Israel prior and during to the Great Tribulation, and especially then even in the city after the Romans invaded. Horns like a lamb suggest righteousness and gentleness, but it's deceptive. He has the voice of the dragon. False prophets can be seen turning people away from Christ and toward Rome. In Acts, you'll have to go home and read it. Read Acts chapter 8, verses 9 and 10. Read Acts chapter 13, verses 6 through 10. You'll see Jewish false prophets pointing people toward Rome. Chapter 13, verses 16 and 17. The mark of the beast, in my notes, equals the beast's ownership. It's the mark of his having control of you. Please buy a copy, it's not expensive, of Last Days Madness. Marvelous book. Very helpful. So he tells you about numerous kinds of interpretations that have all been suggested and will have nothing whatsoever to do with Old Testament or first century activities, all of which would be absolutely unknown and uncalculable for anybody in the first century who was told to calculate the number of the beast. I don't think God's ever going to order you to do something you can't do. So we're not looking, as this list suggests, at Belgian computers, barcodes, food stamps, credit cards, Henry Kissinger, Saddam Hussein, or any of the others, you know, that you see there. None of those make any sense to first century people. The mark's not necessarily a physical thing at all. It's a symbol of the ownership. You belong to Rome. The mark of the beast, then, most likely had to do with the fact, well known in history, that Rome began demanding your pinch of salt offered and burning to the god Rome. And if you didn't swear your allegiance that way, you'd get killed. And the only people who wouldn't were the saints, the Christians of the first century. Very well known historical fact. Now, with 60 seconds to go, what about, you know, this number, 666? Here's wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number. Brethren, in the first century, if you had this book in your hand, you could calculate this number. It is a number that needs to be calculated. The number is that of a man. Though the text, the Greek, does allow, the number is that of man. That, to me, the more I think about it, the less sense that it would make to tell somebody that. You just said it's man. Why give it a number that you have to calculate then? So if the number is man, then the number is man. What's there to calculate? And what would 666 have to do with it? That's not what's happening. It is to calculate a man, which is, again, a proper way to translate the original. So who would this man be that a first century saint could calculate whose number is 666? In other words, what is this mark of the beast? Well, it's not something that would lay in their future, like microchips embedded under the skin, you know, and that kind of stuff. Here are some, but not all, I think, of the clues or criteria that we need. He has great authority over every tribe and tongue and nation. We read that about him. He wages war with the saints. We read that about him. There's arrogance and blasphemy attached, and authority for 42 months. Number five. He is worshipped by those who dwell on the earth, those who do not accept Christ. He marks his worshipers, and with these clues, we're now going to study a thing called gematria. Gematria, well known in antiquity, practiced extensively by the Jews of the first century, numerous historical records of the first century. My personal favorite is this. On a stone wall has been discovered a poem that begins, "Count the numerical value." This stone is from the first century. And on this stone, the archaeologists uncovered it and discovered this poem. It said, "Count the numerical value of the letters in Nero's name. And in murdered his own mother, you'll find the sum is the same." In other words, they did what Romans do. Roman numerals. What is a Roman numeral? It is an alphabetic system which has no numerical symbols. So, letters in the alphabet are assigned numerical values. What does an I mean in the Roman numeral? What does a V mean? Okay? What does an X mean? What does a C mean? Okay? People are very familiar with this. Hebrew and Greek did exactly the same in the first century. Interestingly, I now read from Kenneth Gentry's book, The Beast of Revelation. Several scholars of the last century, gives their names, each stumbled independently upon the name Nero Caesar almost simultaneously. We have seen that the Greek spelling of Nero's name has the value 1005. So you take Nero's name, assign spelled in Greek, take the Greek numerical system, not the Roman numerical system, and it comes to 1005. But a Hebrew spelling of the name, Neron Caesar, it has been documented by archaeological finds that a first century Hebrew spelling of Nero's name provides us with precisely the value 666. J. Stroh's Lexicon of the Talmud contains this very spelling. The numerical valuation is as follows. He gives you the Hebrew letters and what they represent. Nun, Resh, Vav, Nun, Kwaf, Samech, Resh. 50, 200, 6, 50, 100, 60, 200 equals 666. Now, the big question arises, why in a book written to minor or Asia Minor in Greek would you calculate the number in Hebrew? Why not in Greek? For a lot of people, that's just very compelling. They just say, well, that doesn't make sense, and so I will not accept Nero Caesar as the 666. Even though in Hebrew his name adds up that way, I don't think they would have used Hebrew. I think they would have used Greek, and so the number really, you know, isn't going to work. 666 in Greek would have to represent somebody else. In Greek, Nero is 1005. You know, okay. But brethren, maybe another better question would be, well, why not? Why not? But first, you know, look at this. Wisdom and understanding, it declares, are necessary to figure this out. So on the surface, he wasn't trying to make it easy. So let you Greek readers employ wisdom and understanding to figure this out. It would have been very apparent in Greek. It's not so apparent in Hebrew. They would have to think about that, use some understanding and some wisdom to apply the Hebrew lettering system in this case. Hebrew, I think, is actually suggested if you would go back and look at Revelation 9 and verse 11. He's been doing this, I think, already, brethren, not numbering like this, but in Hebrews 9:11, he translates, they have as a king over them the angel of the abyss. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon. In the Greek, he has the name Apollyon. He's encouraging them to think in both Hebrew and in Greek. Look at chapter 16 and verse 16. It gathered them together in the place which in Hebrew is called Armageddon. He doesn't give them a Greek name at all. So this is not very unusual or unexpected or certainly illegal. In fact, they're asked that if they use wisdom and understanding, you might employ the Hebrew lettering rather than the Greek. Hebrew is used elsewhere differently than my number two here. For instance, the word Satan is a Hebrew thing. Hallelujah is Hebrew. Used quite a bit in the book of Revelation. Hebrews throughout the book of Revelation. It's not the least bit surprising that we might use Hebrew to calculate it. There are many Jews in Asia Minor, and the Hebrew alone accounts for something that is profoundly interesting, if not convincing. Brethren, you know how sometimes there are textual variants. Some of the ancient manuscripts say one thing, other ancient manuscripts say another thing. Never contradictory. But in this case, chapter 13:18 has textual variants. Depending on which of the 5,000 manuscripts in the Greek, you know, we have the New Testament you're looking, some say 666. Others say 616. 616. Not 666 at all. Which one's right? Well, people lean in favor of 666. That became the common understanding. But you better know that there is a 66616 rather possibility. We have both in the manuscripts. There were two ways they spelled Nero. One of them without an N. Nero, the way we're familiar, Neron was another spelling. And guess what the N is worth? 50 points. Okay? Now, brother, that really ought to draw you up and say, wowie, I got a first century character that the saints are told to calculate. They can figure it out. Who in the first century could they figure out would be represented by both 666 and 616, so that now you have a perfectly clear understanding of why there are some textual variants. Somebody slipped up making a copy, but he was still saying the same thing, because he knew who it was. Okay? It's Nero, brethren, and that doesn't begin to touch the hem of the garment on why it's Nero. By the book. Okay. Which Kenneth Gentry wrote, that's called The Beast of Revelation. Now please, many other people have come to this. We have a list of scholars on a preceding chart. I'm not leaning on one guy. I'm just saying it's the cheapest book you can find that does a very capable, you know, discussion on many other aspects of this that I'm sure you'll find helpful at least. So, thank you for 7 extra minutes here tonight. Tough chapter. Didn't deal with the heads or horns or anything. We'll see that in chapter 17. But brethren, spike the ball. It's Nero. Okay. For sure, it's Nero. only guy that's going to fit everything that we have here. Now, by the way, everything represents a kingdom and a king. The Roman Empire and the one God who initiated Roman persecution on the saints, the first one ever, was who? Nero. He fits absolutely every one of the qualifiers. And they could figure that out. Okay? Thanks for your time.